And is there not in history a great historical fact which indicates that people as a whole are undergoing this pilgrimage through life, namely the long years of pilgrimage of the Israelites in the desert? You know, it would have taken them only 3 weeks to make that journey from Egypt to the Promised Land. But it took them 40 years. Why? Made a little progress, then went backwards. That's the way life is. We do our best, and we seem to be advancing, and then we slip back. Perfection is such slow, hard work. And finally, they do come to the Promised Land. And they afterwards had the Feast of Tabernacles, in which they erected booths to remind themselves that they had here no lasting city. They were on their way to another Canaan, another holy land, and their Paschal supper. What a story that was, a pilgrimage. They killed the fatted lamb, which to anyone would be the occasion of a banquet. Not to these people. They had to eat it standing. And with their feet shod, and a staff in their hand. Even while before a banquet. They were pilgrims. So whether life finishes at the first stage or the second or the third or any one of the seven stages of Shakespeare, it makes very little difference. In games, we have a goal. Football, we have a goal post. Baseball, we have a home plate. There's something fixed. We have a destiny. And a goal. We wouldn't have a gadget in our house 10 minutes without knowing the purpose of gadget. Why these 3 ages or these 7 ages without first inquiring, why am I here? Where am I going? I know I'm on my way. I ought really to know where. Not very long ago, in a heavy rain, I saw a very interesting sight. I saw a small worm in the mud. Not very far from it, I saw a bird in the mud. The bird had a broken wing. It was dragging it in the mud. I didn't feel sorry for that worm. That was the destiny of the worm. But I felt very sorry for the bird. That was not its medium. It was made to fly. Made for another kind of pilgrimage. And so it is with man. He's made too for something else. And when one knows what it is, this is a great, big, wide, wonderful world in which to love men and God.
Bishop Sheen.
Now we come to hope and Cain. When Cain had killed his brother, he said to God, "Wherever I go, men will seek to kill me." See, there were other men besides Cain on earth. And he became a wanderer upon the earth. Anxiety. Restlessness. in the secular city. He went off to the land of Nod. Now, the word Nod is from the Hebrew word Nod, which means wanderer, that's all. He became restless, like modern man. And when he said to God, "I'm afraid," what did God say? God say, he said, "I will set a mark upon you, that no one may take vengeance upon you." What was that mark? Was it for any of the successors of Cain? Not very likely. What was the mark itself? I don't know. It might have been the blood. The blood that was on his hands. Abel's blood that he couldn't wash off. Could have been that. Blood like that which stained the hands of Lady Macbeth, who said, "Will not all the waters of the seven seas wash this blood incarnadine from my hands?" But at any rate, he was given a sign. You see, the sign was not vengeance. It was to protect him from vengeance. God was giving him a sign like that rainbow in the sky after the flood. A covenant of mercy. In other words, Cain, you'll not be revenged. Vengeance belongs to me, not to men. So he surrounded him with what? Surrounded him with mercy. Very much like, for example, the judges in the Middle Ages, whenever they sentenced anyone to death, had to receive communion with that man the day of his death in order to remind them, the condemned man, that after all, though I'm executing justice, you belong to a greater realm of mercy and understanding and compassion. And so what God did was surround him with compassion, with mercy. And that mark was a sign, you're God's property. You don't belong to men so that they can kill you. You're mine. And the Arabic word gainel means slave of God, which is probably a word that was taken from this very mark of Cain. Now let's modernize Cain and the murder of Abel. And let us go to a modern Cain and a modern Abel. To the assassination of Martin Luther King. He's slain by another. There's a trial. In the course of the trial, evidence is adduced against Cain, the assassin. Prosecuting attorney points out that exactly the same fingerprints that are found on a gun were found on objects which he left in a room. Witnesses come forward to attest that they saw the modern Cain fly from the scene of the crime. Other corroborating evidence is brought forward, and there's no doubt whatever in the mind of the judge that Abel was slain by Cain or Martin Luther King by an assassin. But during the trial, there are rumors, just rumors. One rumor was that Martin Luther King appeared in Memphis. Another, that he was seen walking in the city of Atlanta. And another, that he was with the poor in Washington. There were only rumors. Nobody believed them. The press would not even print the rumors. And just at the moment that the judge sentences Martin Luther King, sentences the assassin of Martin Luther King, Cain, to death, Martin Luther King walks into the courtroom. Cain would say, Where's the corpus delicti? How can you dare say that I have killed a man when this man stands before you alive? I am not a murderer. Martin Luther King says, yes, I am alive. The judge says there's nothing left for me to do but to release you, King. For he who is dead is alive. And there was another Cain. A race of Cains, you and I. And we slew another Abel, the just Abel. And he said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And rumors began to fly about that he was seen in several places. That he actually was not dead. That he was alive. And he's seen walking on the wings of the morning. And if the modern Cain cannot be guilty of slaying the modern Abel, if that Abel is alive, then is not the hope of all of the modern Cains in this mark that was put upon him by a merciful God, is not their salvation in the fact that they too are saved by the just Abel. In other words, one of the great hopes of the world is we're just not optimists, we're in a certain sense kind of pessimists. We start with the worst. We saw evil in the strongest moment defeated. We saw ourselves loved when we were most unlovable. When we slew innocents. And so we've come forth from under the modern Abel, ever conscious of the fact that we live by what we slay.
Love is
its springtime, summer, its bearing of children of fruit, autumn, and also as its winter. And to love through all the seasons is a great joy. And here I'm going to read for you perhaps a poem that you know. Elizabeth Barrett Browning's poem to her husband. How do I love you? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach. Revealing out of sight for the ends of being an ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet mood. By sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with the passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with the love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears, all my life, and if God choose, I shall but love thee better after this. Such are the seasons where, at first, the body leads the soul, and later on, it is the soul that leads the body. Now there is the last point of all. One thing we have not found in our garden. It's something invisible. The invisible forces which work on a garden. Yes, here's the growth of this rose or lily, whatever it happens to be. Do you explain its growth simply by the planting of the seed and by the earth? Think of the tremendous invisible forces. The atmosphere.
son, the dew, the hidden chemicals. Actually, more of them go into the developing of this rose or this lily than does the earth in anything you can touch. And so there's something unseen and invisible in all love. And that's the source of love itself, which is God. I just cannot conceive a young man being in love and not loving God. I can't conceive it. This is the invisible force that pulls them on. That's why they speak of our love. Something bigger and better than just your love and mine. It's not the sum of two. Something bigger than both of us, as they say. Certainly there are ecstasies. But if human flesh can give it, then whence does it come? And so may couples say, in this beautiful ecstasy of love, if the human heart can so thrill me, what must be the heart of God? If the spark is so bright, what must be the flame?
The scriptures tell
me. Why are many young people today aggressive? They're aggressive because they've never received love. A study made of juvenile delinquents in England proved that the delinquents that came from divorced parents, or there was no love of father and mother, were guilty of the most serious crimes and also repeated their crimes more than the others. So the touch of the hand then brings us not only in communion with those that are in need of love, but it also infects them with our goodness and our kindness and our mercy. And I have 2 minutes and 11 seconds to go. Now, I had another point to tell you. And I know this is the one now that will make you curious, because I'm not telling it to you. I don't have time. I can't start it. And so the problem is, you see in television, what do you do in 2 hours, in 2 minutes, and or 1 minute and 58 seconds? You get very nervous and you say, oh, what am I going to do with the time? But we'll save the other point for you. I merely want now to suggest to you that the problem of race and class will be solved in part by settling our abstract questions of rights, but it will be settled practically and concretely by love. And the burden of love falls on those who have. After all, example, God loves me. There's no reason in the world why God should love me. Absolutely none. Now, I don't know whether you think you're very lovable or not, but probably in very honest moments you admit that you too are not very lovable. But God loves you. Just as he loves me. Well, why does he love me? Why does he love you? If there's nothing very lovable in us. He loves us because he puts some of his love into us. His love into us. And that's why we're supremely and divinely lovable. So down to the inner city. Touch children, touch people. Live with them, mingle with them, do the divine thing. Put a little love into them, and everyone will become lovable.